podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, to the day before the second test match at Manchester. England trying to get back into the series, of course, after that rather humbling defeat at the hands of the South African fast bowlers at Lord's last week. We're just talking before the England team has been announced, if they announce it on the day before the game, which they sometimes do now. On this day, by the way, in 1980, was the first ever floodlit game in England between Essex and the touring West Indians, played at Stamford Bridge. So that just gives you a little sense, 1980, 42 years ago, when floodlit cricket first came to England. And I think you think, Simon, that the floodlights might be needed in Manchester for this test match, because there's slightly gloomy weather forecast.
Well, I think the forecast is not too bad, but of course what you do get at this time of the year, you get that light that fades a bit early. So you might need them on at 6 o'clock, 6:30. They bowl their overs quite slowly, don't they, these days? Yeah, so good luck facing that South African pace bowling attack at 6:15. I mean, it depends on the configuration of the game, of course. You never quite know who's going to be batting at whatever time. But talking about back in the day, 1980, 1976, Michael Holding and all that at the Oval, 16 wickets. You've had a text from him, haven't you, in response to one of your articles?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned him, actually, in my sort of review of the test match, talking about the South African fast bowlers and saying, you know, they are the fastest combination of bowlers that England face for a good time, maybe 20 years, maybe more, actually. Their average speed on that third day was 86 miles an hour, and that compares very favourably with those great West Indies attacks of the 80s, of which Michael Holding was obviously a significant part. And he read my piece. In fact, I even said that I thought Rabada was the modern incarnation of Whispering Death, because he sort of ghosts very silently, glides to the wicket and then unleashes the thunderbolts, just like Michael Holding used to. And Holding has just sent me a text saying, a friend of mine sent me the article you wrote about the South African bowling attack. As a former quickie, I was grinning throughout. Sorry I wasn't there to see it live. Pace always separates the men from the boys, irrespective of where you're born or where you learn your cricket.
Absolutely.
Very true. Yeah.
I remember actually Tony Cozier, doing an interview with Tony Cozier before the Ashes series of 2005. It might have been the same year, it might have been the year before. It probably was the same year. And England were playing a match, I think, at Headingley. I just don't remember, it really caught in my mind at the time, actually. And I said to him, do you think England have got a chance this summer against Australia? And at the time, it felt a little bit fanciful. I know England have been doing quite well. And he said, yes, I do, because they've got four quick bowlers. And when you can get four quick bowlers together, you've got an opportunity. Okay, Matthew Hoggard wasn't express pace, but they had Simon Jones, who was quick, Andrew Flintoff, who was quick, and they had Steve Harmison, who was quick, and they had Matthew Hoggard more than capable other option as well. And so, yeah, there you go. You get four quick bowlers together. Mind you, I mean, England had four pace bowlers together at Lord's, but the difference being they bowled, you know, sort of 82, something like that. And South Africa, you say, were at average 86. And England, what was England's average? Probably about 80, 81, something like that, over the course of the test match.
Yeah. And there is a significant difference, actually. And, you know, a lot of bowlers bowl 80, 81, 82. Not so many bowl above 86. And it's just that difference. It's that 5 miles an hour, which does make a difference to a batsman. It's probably about 0.02 of a second difference in reaction time. But it is key. And if you look at somebody like Johnny Bairstow playing against Anrich Nokia in that last test match, he was late on quite a number of deliveries, some of the ones that got him out, but some of the ones he missed as well. And it does separate the men from the boys, as Michael Holding said. Incidentally, on this show today, we've also got, talking of sort of yesteryear, we've also got England's previous coach from the last 5 years or so, Trevor Bayliss, who was our guest in the Virtual Cricket Club last night, talking about the current England side, his coaching philosophy, and also quite interesting stuff about Ben Stokes and his view of him when he first met him, and his thoughts that he could be a fine captain. Stokes, of course, very much the talking point this week with his documentary about to be launched on Amazon on Friday, and various headlines already cropping up regarding that.
I was actually late to this recording of our podcast, Yods, because I overslept this morning. And while I was sleeping, I actually had a dream that Joe Root replaced Ben Stokes as England captain for this test match. And also, the England selectors called up David Lawrence. So, you know how you get really
Sid, they called you not David, you mean David Lawrence from Dan Lawrence or
no,
David
Lawrence.
Lawrence,
yeah, the old Sid Lawrence, the old fast bowler. They called him in for this test match. Perhaps that was just sort of subconsciously that thing. England do need a little bit of pace in their attack. They also called up a mystery spinner I'd never heard of as well. Anyway, not dreams, they're really funny, but there we go. On the eve of the game, we probably shouldn't speculate too much about team changes because we're recording before England have named their side. But let's just lay down a marker for people to laugh at us after, if they listen to this after the England team has been announced. Do you think England are going to make any changes or many?
I don't think they are. Well, I wouldn't at the moment because I think that, as Michael Holding and many other people have said, it's a challenge facing that attack. And England have seen it now, and now they know what to expect. And I think they'll be wiser and maybe confronted in a different way. Perhaps the pitch will be different. So there's lots of other sort of factors. But I don't think it will be... it's like a poison chalice, really, giving, say, Harry Brook the opportunity to go and open the batting against this attack when he's never played a test match. And he's been playing in the 100 for the last couple of weeks, playing well, but it's a slightly different challenge. So I don't think I'd be changing the batting order, and I don't think I'd be changing the bowling either. They've just got to bowl a bit better. They were a bit rusty in that first test. They've just got to bowl better.
Yeah, my hunch is that they won't change very much, if anything at all. I mean, the one thing I could see them doing is bringing in Ollie Robinson for one of the pace bowlers, unlikely to be... Well, it won't be Jimmy Anderson, I shouldn't think, in his home ground. Possibility of Stuart Broad, possibility of Matthew Potts. So that's the only thing I think they can do. But I think it's one of those, isn't it? Sometimes you have a heavy defeat. And in the past, they were right, got to be changes. There was a sort of outcry. We've got to have four changes, got to do something about it. But they're much less inclined to do that these days. They're much more inclined to say, right, just play better. We won well early in the summer. Yeah, you also hope as well that I talked about the configuration of the game earlier, that might be a bit different this time. You might, win a good toss or whatever, or you might bat first on a sunny day in a nice flat pitch or something like that, so you get the factors in your favour. I think the feeling was that Lords, South Africa, did have the better of the conditions. They had good conditions to bowl in, but that's not to in any way sort of undermine, denigrate or their performance. I thought they played supremely well, and they put England under pressure throughout the match. Actually, that has been a feature, hasn't it, some of the conversation sort of post-match, is that England want to play in this style, and Brendan McCullum saying, well, perhaps we allowed them to dictate, that we didn't try to enforce our game on them enough, actually. So, people said, oh, England didn't lose because of their Baz ball approach. Oh, no, I've mentioned that word, sorry. The Brendan McCullum approach. But what he was saying was that perhaps we should have tried to be a bit more aggressive against them. I don't know how you do that against that.
Well, it all happened too quickly. Yeah. It was... crushed out of existence before it even started, really. They never got into first gear. So it was the impressive performances of the South Africans getting those early wickets. Alex Lees, unfortunately, played a pretty terrible shot in the first innings, and that just opened the door. And then
wasn't that a shot that was we talked about at the time, was sort of out of character with the way he generally plays? Okay, I know he was aggressive. I know he was aggressive at Birmingham. It was a lovely sunny day, and the pitch was flat and dry by them in that second innings when him and Crawley put on that wonderful partnership. But to me, it just seemed a shot out of character, out of character with his sort of basic nature of his sort of batting over the years. And also, certainly out of character with the conditions at the time. And it wasn't even on the up, really, he was trying to hit it, was it? Sometimes you say, oh, yeah, hit it on the up. It wasn't even that full. It certainly wasn't half volley. It wasn't.
And that's a really good point. And interestingly, and we'll hear from Trevor Bayliss shortly, but one of the points he made about the transformation that he helped create in England's one-day side in 2015 was identifying the players who could deliver their more aggressive, positive method of play. And one of those people was Jason Roy, who naturally is an aggressive player. And you remember, you know, the first match of England's sort of rejuvenation, second coming, whatever you want to call it, in 2015 against New Zealand at Edgbaston. Roy played a big shot to the first ball of the match against New Zealand and was out, caught backward point. But it didn't stop them, England, from seizing that initiative and playing that way. And it didn't stop Roy from being
it was his natural
sort of enforcer.
Game. Because
it was his natural game. Whereas you're right, you're putting Lees into a situation or trying to get him to play in a way that isn't natural to him. So that's a problem, because I think there's a disconnect between how Lees wants to actually play really, and how McCullum and the rest of the team want him to play, want England to play. So yeah, it's a problem. That I mean, maybe he can, you know, create a new way of playing for himself, and there were signs that he could in that previous few test matches, but it just didn't look natural somehow.
I agree with you. I mean, he has said himself that when he was younger, he was nicknamed Haydos, wasn't he, or something like that. You know that I think when he was younger, perhaps he was a bit more aggressive, and as he's grown older, he's sort of learnt to sort of tailor his game to the conditions and give himself time. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. It might just one of those things. You know, you play a shot like that, you nick it, and he'd already played one, he sliced it over the top of the slips. You might go to Old Trafford and there might be a nice flat surface, sunny day. I think the weather is going to be reasonably decent over the next few days, and it comes off, and you look back and you think, well, Lords is one of those things. I perhaps just was a fraction aggressive a bit too early. But yeah, well, we'll see how Alex Lees's career develops. I mean, his record so far, albeit on a much smaller sample, is no better than Zach Crawley's. So that's where England have their problem. Or one of their problems, I think, is that at the top of the order, and we'll see how that develops in this test match and at the Oval as well. It's actually a really intriguing battle now, isn't it? I must say, coming into this series, I thought that England probably would just be a bit too strong for South Africa. I think mainly because I wasn't convinced that, well, Rabada, there was a big question mark over Rabada's fitness. Olofea went down with injury. How is South Africa going to configure it? But actually, getting them all on the pitch, all firing together, worked really well for them at Lords. And they've got a decent spinner as well.
Well, two different decent spinners. They play Simon Harmer, but I'm sure he's struggling to get in the team now after that first test, which Maharaj had an influence on as well, didn't he? He got those two early wickets in the second inning. So very well balanced side. I mean, England have to focus on the South African batting and think to themselves, we can knock these guys over.
Yeah, I saw Neil Manthorpe actually coming away from Lords, you know, the respected South African journalist and broadcaster who's seen, you know, probably just about every game they've played since readmission, I imagine. And he said to me, I said, yeah, that was a good win for South Africa. Neil, he said, yeah. He said, but South Africa, they've got 160 all out in them as well. So, you know, different venue, different day, different, you know, things can change around. And we saw actually the last series between these two teams, South Africa won the first test well in Centurion. They gave England a good hiding. And every now and again, in England, they've given England a good hiding. And a reasonable amount of regularity, England have fought back. So, yeah, another, I mean, really fascinating test match in prospect. I think perhaps the authorities will be hoping it lasts a bit more than 2.5 days. I met someone last night, a friend of mine, who had a ticket for Saturday. And, you know, really disappointed, you know, no cricket. And they must have lost, I don't know whether it's insured or not, but they must have lost an enormous amount of money not being able to play on that fourth day, which is the Saturday of a Lord's Test match in August.
Saturday of the Lord's Test as well. You know, everybody's looking forward to it. Lots of, obviously, members and fans and so on. It's a highlight of the summer for many people. So it was a really sad thing. I suggested a beer match, in fact, didn't I? But obviously those things don't happen these days.
No, you're talking about the 19th century for that sort of thing to happen. I thought they were club matches. I mean, I'm sure people have played in club matches where you've lost. You know, you're bowled out for 30 or something like that. The opposition knock them off, and then you have a beer match later. I mean, it's a bit of a club tradition.
What's the lowest score you've ever heard from a club team?
Well, the one that sticks in my mind, and this is not a club team, this is a school match. I remember playing a cup match at school, and we bowled the opposition out for 10. That's the lowest score I can remember.
My dad played in a team for London Theatres, actually, which was bowled out for 7. Mm. And, well, you know, you can't really imagine it, can you?
Well,
able to get more than 11 players.
It's not much fun, actually, is it? I mean, you when you go out and play, especially as a club cricketer, I mean, if you play at top level, you bowl a team out for next to nothing, you're absolutely delighted because you just want to win, don't you? But the level I'm talking about, you want to win, but it's also about having that competition, that enjoyment as well. You want to go have a chance to bat for 2 or 3 hours, don't you, as well? You don't want to be, you know, after going back for 4 balls to knock off the 10 you need to win.
Even the worst players somehow managed to get runs. One of my sons was playing on Sunday and he said, this guy came into bat and he stood sort of virtually at right angles to the wicket instead of side on, front on, and tried to kind of basically ramp everything with all his legs all over the place. And he got about 15 runs. So it's I don't know, it's the beauty of our ridiculous game, isn't it? Yeah.
For nearly 4 decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Just thought, actually, Yoz, before we hear from Trevor Bayliss, you were talking about the floodlit match in 1980 between Essex and the West Indies. I mean, can they have imagined back then what they were going to unleash? I mean, I suppose we'd already seen it, hadn't we, in World Series cricket with Kerry Packer. So it was sort of becoming the new thing. Can we do it over here? And, you know, they did it at a football ground, didn't they? I think they played... they might have played a game at Ashton Gate as well in Bristol. You know, they were experimenting with playing cricket in football grounds. It didn't really work.
Well, it didn't actually, because I went to one of those games at Stamford Bridge, and they tried to position the pitch, an artificial pitch, kind of at diagonal to the football sort of structure, and so that not all the boundaries were ridiculously short. Well, if you put it in the middle, if you align it with in the same way as a football pitch, you've just got ridiculously short square boundaries. So by doing a diagonal, you've got a sort of deeper mid-wicket boundary into the corner, if you like.
Yeah.
But then you've also got a sort of ridiculous Mickey Mouse square leg boundary. And it was just a little poke for 6. So it never worked. They tried it, of course, in America as well, playing cricket in baseball stadiums. And again... The dimensions of the ground were just made it a bit of a mockery.
Who would have thought, actually, the answer ultimately, Yoz, was to put floodlights in cricket grounds? Amazing, isn't it, that someone eventually came up with that idea? But of course, I'm just slightly digressing. Of course, what used to happen was the temporary floodlights. Can you remember those? Before they had permanent floodlights, and they were pretty hopeless. You can barely see. So the team batting second... invariably lost, didn't they, when they had those...
Well, they were just borrowed from railway sidings, weren't they?
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Okay, Yoz, let's move on to Trevor Bayliss. One of the sort of the talking points this week, and it's because, you know, Ben Stokes, England captain, and on Friday they're going to release this film made by Sam Mendes about his life, and inevitably Ben Stokes has been doing the pre-publicity for this film, because they obviously want to get as many people to watch it as possible, and he's given lots of individual interviews to various people. But you've been speaking to Trevor Bayliss about Stokes as England captain, and you asked him the question, didn't you? Did he see Ben Stokes as a potential England captain way back when?
think it was when we were in Bangladesh and Cookie was still the captain, and obviously Joe Root was the heir apparent to take over that captaincy. And I know the written journalist asked me after the game one day about, you know, was there anyone else other than Joe Root that could be captain of England? And I suggested Ben Stokes, to which they all laughed. I said, no, I'm serious. And they, you know, that shut him up a little bit, because he was a leader of men. You know, he was one of those guys that a lot of the other guys in the team were attracted to. You know, if he was speaking, or if he was having a beer, or, you know, there was always guys around him. The guys were just attracted to him. And when he spoke in a team meeting, or, you know, after a game, everyone listened. And if something had to be, like if someone disagreed with me, for example, which I'm not afraid of, he would be the one that would speak up. You know, even to Straussie. I know Straussie, when we went to the India for the 2016 T20 World Cup, Straussie came over to have a meeting, and he wanted to have a meeting before one of the games. And Stokesy went to Paul Farbrace and said he didn't think it was the right time to have a meeting, which should be after the match. So they, you know, they both came to my room, which I agreed with. So we went and saw Straussie, and Stokesy told him what he thought. So he changed things around. You know, he was a bit of a spokesperson for the rest of the team.
Tell us the story about your first meeting with Stokes, a proper sort of encounter on the golf course in Spain, I think, wasn't it?
That's right. I arrived here in London, and I think about 2 days later, we flew out to Spain for a 3-day cricket camp, if you like. We didn't do much cricket. We did a little bit of fielding and catching, but it was pretty much a sort of 3 days for them to get to know me and me to get to know them. Yeah, first or second day there was a game of golf on, and you know, I'd only met the guys half an hour before, for example, and I was teeing off on a par 3 and hooked it into the bushes, and Stokes and Mark Wood were coming up the par 4 just near where we're hitting off, and you know, he sledged me for hitting it into the trees. You know, I just thought to myself, he's a bloke, you know, he's not afraid to actually speak up. You know, he's getting stuck into the new coach, and he doesn't really know me. So that just made me feel like, well, he's a bloke that, you know, he's not afraid to speak his mind, and not afraid to speak up.
And I guess you've observed what England had done under his leadership since. So I guess probably it doesn't surprise you that they've sort of taken the bull by the horns and shaken it and given it a really good going over.
Yeah, it's been exciting. It's been exciting to watch. You know, look, it's not going to work every single time, but it's, how do they react to that? I think possibly similar to what we did in the one day setup was early on, we fell over a few times trying to make some big scores. And but what we said to the guys was, like, let's test the ceiling and see how good we'll see how high we can go. We're going to fall over a few times, but we will learn from it. Things may change a little bit as you go, but let's test the ceiling. If we don't test the ceiling and see what we can do, well, we don't know how good, you know, we can be. So that was our approach, or one of our approaches in the one day game. And I think maybe to a certain degree, that's, you know, I don't know. I haven't spoken to them since I've been here, but yeah, that may be one of the philosophies, with Stokesy and Baz McCullum for the test team.
In a way, I mean, I've thought this all along, actually. Baz Ball is really Trev Ball. I mean, in the sense that you and Morgan and obviously a couple of senior players brought in that new kind of liberated way of playing and, you know, no holds barred, no blame, just, you know, make good decisions, but be positive all the time.
Yeah. Look, I think it's... I found myself trying to explain what being positive and aggressive was for 3 or 4 years. You know, I did come in and say, if I changed anything, if I did change anything, or if I went back and I had to change something, it would be explain that a little better at the very beginning. I came in and said, look, I think the question was, you know, how do you want the team to play? And I said, well, you know, good, positive, aggressive cricket. You know, what I was trying to explain, then explained for the next 3 or 4 years was being positive and aggressive. He's not hitting fours and six or trying to hit fours and sixes every ball. It's being it's having a positive mindset. Because if you've got a positive mindset, the runs do come. The longer you bat, the more runs you're able to score, the easier it is to score. Yes, by all means, you've got to do some hard yards early sometimes. Other times you can get away, just depending on what the bowlers serve up. But it's about having a positive mind. If you've got a positive mind and you are looking to score and not just survive, for example, you make good decisions. You know, you defend well, you leave well. You know, you're looking for the quick single. And when the bad ball comes away, you're in that positive frame of mind. Before you know it, it's racing away to the fence.
Is it also a little bit about if a player is out playing positively, to not castigate them or question it, maybe to analyse it later, but to encourage that positivity so that if players feel afraid or nervous, that they can kind of try and express themselves. And I'm not really articulate, but it's a very difficult thing to articulate this, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the perfect example of that is Jason Roy in the one-day team. Before Ashley arrived in London, I'd been appointed, and they had a series against New Zealand where Jason debuted, I think. And just, you know, being on the phone to Morgs and Paul Farbrace, you know, what the changes we wanted to make to the team, or the changes Morgs wanted to make to the team, was to get those positive players in. Jason was one of those players that we'd identified at the top of the order, and we gave him a certain role to get us off to a quick start. But we also said to him, look, if it doesn't work, we're not going to drop you for playing your role, and to give him that confidence. So he had that. I think he missed out in most of those games.
Oh no, the first game, he was out first ball.
Yeah.
It's New Zealand at Edgbaston. I remember it. 2015, yeah. May, June. He got a big drive at the first ball of the game, I think from Trent Bolt, and sliced it to backward point. He was out, naught. Yeah. Yeah. But he never looked back, really, did he?
That's right. I think hopefully giving him the confidence that, I've been given a job to do, and I'm going to go out and try and do that. And if it doesn't work out, playing that style of game, yeah, it has got its risks if you don't execute properly. So we couldn't sort of tell him, well, that was his job, and then after one or two failures, get rid of him. You know, we had confidence in him that he was the right guy for the job. Hopefully he felt that confidence, and, you know, I'd like to think he did feel it, because he obviously played a big role in winning that World Cup 4 years later.
You have a transformative effect on cricketers you work with. You've obviously achieved a huge amount with Sri Lanka when you coached them. You achieved a lot in the IPL when you coached teams there, and come to England, transformed England's one day side, test match team, stayed, you know, fairly steady, and now you've London Spirit, who were the sort of wooden spoonists last year, absolutely terrible. Now they're punching at the top of the table as well. So, I mean, I know you're a modest man who doesn't claim any credit, but I mean, what do you think you have done? Well, so what have you done for the London Spirit? How have you managed to make them play so well?
Look, I think my approach as a coach at the highest levels, with all the teams that I've been with, it's pretty much about trying to play with a smile on your face. You know, these guys are at the top level, are experienced players. They've got a high skill level, and they're underneath enough pressure as it is, you know, in front of the media and in front of big crowds. And I think it's just about, as I said, you know, playing the game for the reasons you took it up in the first place, and that's because you love playing the game, and trying to instill that in the players, you know, and throwing a few bad dad jokes every now and then, and, you know, they take the mickey out of you, and you play with a smile on their face, and that seems to take, you know, some pressure off them when they go out to perform in the middle. And, you know, if someone's trying to play their role and it's not quite coming off, that we don't actually drop them necessarily straight away, that we send a message not just to them but the rest of the team that you know, it's okay to fail as long as you learn from it.
We've got a lovely story. You kindly gave up your time in Sydney about a year ago or so in an interview we did for the World Cup documentary that we've made. And I know all our club members have heard a lot about this doc. And you told a lovely story in it, actually, which I'm not going to play because I'm going to play another little bit. But you told a lovely story about Jason Roy. And the first one of the first times you met him, he came into the changing rooms with J. Roy written on his shoes. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, it was I think it was a warm-up down in Southampton, actually, and he came out with his shoes embroidered with J. Roy on the back. So just to have a bit of fun with him, you know. I'm not necessarily in favour of people big-noting themselves, I suppose, but he came out, so I just took the opportunity. I put a bit of tape on the back of my shoes and wrote TB on it and said, you know, you're not the only one that can have your name on the shoes, which, you know, got a bit of a laugh out of him and the players as well. So just sort of breaks the ice, you know, and as I said, you know, try to get the boys to play with a smile on their face.
Actually, I think it's things like that that are really important, aren't they? Because firstly, it just stops people from, I think it was your phrase actually, getting too big for their boots. But yeah, also, it does bring a bit of humour in, and it diffuses possible, I don't know, jealousy or, you know, kind of players sort of looking down on each other or looking up on each other. It diffuses that a bit.
Look, I can't really explain exactly what it is or the way I go about things, but that approach is just me. You know, as I said before, you know, I want the players to go out and be themselves. And it was one of the promises I made to myself when I first got the New South Wales head coach's role in 2004, that I'd had a bit of success at underage levels as a coach. I made a promise to myself that, you know, I wouldn't change. I'd approach things in the same manner. And I've tried to do that right through, you know, first-class cricket, you know, franchise cricket, and two international teams that I've done. Hopefully that's had a small part to do in some of the success of, you know, I've been involved with or the teams have achieved that I've coached. Yeah, the main thing is you do need some good players in your teams to have that success.
So Trevor Bayliss, of course, is here coaching the London Spirit, talking of floodlights. They're in action tonight at Lord's, playing Welsh Fire and doing well, actually. And interestingly, Trevor has had... He's had a really, you know, sort of cathartic influence on a number of teams he's coached. Obviously, he really enhanced Sri Lanka's prowess, especially in one-day cricket when he was coached there. He did very well with the Kolkata Knight Riders, which is where he first connected with Owen Morgan in the IPL. Obviously, lifted England up to World Cup triumph. And now he's got London Spirit second in the table. They were actually leading the 100 until recently. They were bottom last year. So, again, he's had a transformative effect on the teams. And, I mean, he's certainly had a big effect on Stokes. I remember him telling me that, you know, early on in Stokes's sort of tenure with Bayliss in about 2017, he was just aware of how hard he was training. And, you know, he said that, didn't he? He explained how it's important for Stokes to sort of leave something for the match, really. And Stokes listened, and certainly that helped his own performance. And, you know, actually talking about the documentary and Stokes' sort of influence, it was him saying to the team before that India match in the 2019 World Cup, "I'm nervous, I'm fearful that we're going to get knocked out here," which in a way gave everybody else sort of emboldened all the other players to be honest about their own feelings and brought everybody together and re-engaged them with the way they wanted to play. And they blitzed India in that key match.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how I'm sure everybody in various walks of life, work, whatever, social life, I don't know, local club, whatever, there's a character in that club, male or female, that just has that presence about them, that when they speak, people listen. They're not necessarily the leader. You probably had it when you were playing. I know you had Mike Brealey as captain, but I bet there was a really strong personality in the dressing room. I mean, sometimes it's perhaps not for good, actually. It can be sometimes a negative influence, but there's always that strong character. The people also that they respect. They're also slightly fearful of as well. There's that sort of, I don't know, that sort of brooding presence. I don't know whether that's something that you recognise. I think back to the, I think back to sort of social situations. It might be, I don't know, it might be in your class at school. There's always somebody who just, you're a bit wary of. It's not quite the right word, but there's that feeling of sort of, sort of respect from a slight distance sometimes.
Well, I mean, quite intimidating. John Embry was definitely the character, I think, in the Middlesex dressing room that had that sort of attitude that he didn't say much, that certainly he didn't say much that wasn't a swear word. Mm. But but when he said something, when he looked disappointed, he was an ultimate professional. And he didn't talk a lot about how he was going to play. He just performed. But if he came off the field and looked a little bit disconsolate and said something like, "That was effing pissole," you just knew that everyone had not lived up to the standards. And he would then kind of just perhaps elaborate a little bit. But he was someone you wanted to earn their respect. I think it's about earning a player's respect, because you see how they carry themselves and how dedicated they are and how consistent and professional they are and how much they care. And so you want to make sure that you win that person's respect and abide by their principles, really.
Yeah, that Trevor told that story about when he said that Ben Stokes was the character who could become an England captain to the media back in Bangladesh. I must have been there for that. I'm just trying to remember it back, because my instinct was I don't remember laughing when he said that. But I mean, these things, it's a long time ago. Did he seem an obvious leader way back when? I don't know. He had sort of a bit of that sort of wildness about him, didn't he? I suppose that was what it was.
I think I always thought that a team needs a captain who's quite composed. And resourceful, and someone who's a sort of warrior-like figure to lead them on the field and get going. You know, when the tough gets going, they get going, kind of thing. And obviously, Michael Vaughan had Andrew Flintoff, Mike Brearley had Ian Botham and Bob Willis, and Ben Stokes is that character that Joe Root had or didn't have at various times. So, in a way, I always felt that Stokes, could he be captain and have that warrior-like spirit as well? And I don't think it's an easy thing to combine.
No, because the point is that the examples that you gave there, Ian Botham and Andrew Flintoff, they didn't turn out to be particularly effective captains, did they? I mean, Both might say, well, I was given a poison chalice of X number of test matches against West Indies, and probably anyone who was captain at that time would have struggled in those series against West Indies. And he was quite young as well. Andrew Flintoff took England to the Ashes. That didn't work out. But Ben Stokes, well, he's won 4 out of 6. I mean, it could go horribly wrong, couldn't it? It could be relatively short lived as well. Ben Stokes' 10 years as England captain, we don't quite know how it's going to. Of course, we don't quite know how it's going to pan out. He has lost 2 Test matches so far as captain. One to quite an ordinary West Indies side in England, and one to an absolute shellacking from South Africa. And actually, in all the games he's captained so far, I mean, you think sort of the natural order of things is England would have gone on to lose those games. So they managed to drag themselves out of some tough situations on another day. They might be looking at 0 from 6 so far, but if the ifs and buts of sport, there we go.
Yeah. Well, England have got to play better, that's for sure, in this second Test match, and we'll be doing a daily review of each day's play from Thursday onwards. So I hope you can join us for that, and thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.